Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is editor Simon Lambert and assistant editor Helen Crane. And coming up, sudden wealth syndrome. What to do if you win the lottery and become mega rich overnight? There are worse conditions to have than that. Or you could win at the premium bonds. They've become a little more appealing this week as NS&I finally edge up the rate. If you think property renovation is your winning financial ticket, you might want to think again. While another way to lose lots of money is by renting a car on holiday, we look at the soaring prices. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a couple from Gloucestershire became the biggest winners of the Euro Millions this month, taking £180 million. We've all dreamt about what we'd buy, a round the world trip, a house in Barbados, Derby County Football Club. But how do you actually deal with the reality of becoming mega rich overnight? Well, the first thing lottery owner Camelot do is offer the winners a financial advisor. Very sensible, but what do they advise? We'll get into that. But firstly, the dream. Simon, Helen, what would be the first thing that you would do with a big lottery win?
Well, you dream about winning that kind of sum of money. 184 million, a life-changing sum of money. Not the kind of money that you think, that would be amazing, I'd be a multimillionaire, but I could see how you could spend 5 million. 184 million, I'd like to think that you wouldn't manage to get through that. But I do think that maybe the first thing that would happen is you'd be struck by almost a paralysis of, what do? What do I spend it on? Where do I go? I mean, obviously there's the things that you would maybe dream of, the large house, the country estate, the classic cars, holiday. Which just one do you do
immediately
first?
Immediately.
Like, you can't buy a house immediately.
All right, but you're under pressure now, Simon. Come on. I've just given you 180 million check and it's just gone into your bank account and you've gone, great, right, Mrs. Lambert and little Lambert. Where are we off to?
I actually think the first thing I would do would probably be to go on holiday.
Snowboarding.
It's the wrong time of year for that at the moment. Oh, well, if it was winter, yes.
There must be somewhere in the world you can go that's the right time of the year, the Antarctic or something.
It's always snowing somewhere. No, I think I'd go somewhere sunny, probably somewhere nice and expensive where you could relax. I don't know whether it would be a luxury hotel, though. I'm not that into this whole swanky, pampered hotel experience. Definitely not my children. I could just see it as being slightly stressful with them. I think I'd probably rent myself a very nice palatial house in some kind of amazing surroundings, overlooking the beach, maybe watching the surf roll in, and then have a good think about what I was going to do. I think I'd probably be quite tempted to go out and buy myself a car. Straight off the bat, just because I like cars, maybe some form of classic car, maybe an E-Type. Really, I would really like an E-Type. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I would like an E-Type. An old 911, quite like one of those. I've always wanted to own a Ferrari, actually. Yeah. So I've just bought three cars.
I don't think you'd be worried by paralysis, Simon. I think you could really go for it.
Yeah, I know. But I think I think the first thing I'd do is treat myself and my family to a good time and a time away from everything whilst I tried to get my head round the fact that my life had inexorably changed. And we'll go on to this when we discuss this more. The life of my family and my extended family has probably inexorably changed, because with 184 million, you're looking down the barrel of, not only might you never have to work again, well, actually you shouldn't have to work again with 184 million, but maybe you can set up quite a lot of your family so that they don't have to work again.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, isn't it, Helen? We're going to talk about premium bonds later, and it seems an extraordinary world where you think that, you know, winning the jackpot of a million is, well, it's a nice to have. It's very nice to have, don't get me wrong. But it's unlikely to change your life in a way that you won't have to work, all those sorts of things. Whereas £184 million, what would be the first sort of impulse buy you'd make?
As soon as the money or some of the money hits my bank account, I'm just going shopping. I'm way more materialistic than Simon. I'm going down Bond Street. I'm buying a Chanel bag. I'm buying a Burberry trench coat. All the classic expensive fashion purchases. I'm buying it all.
I like that idea, but I don't like shopping. So what I'd do is I'd hire a personal shopping person who would just do it for me. Anything else? Holidays?
Yeah, I think my holiday would be to the Galapagos Islands.
It's amazing. Go.
Is it? Very obscure place. Quite expensive. I'd go there for a month, hang out with the lizards, have a great time, think about how I'm going to spend the rest of my money, which I don't think would actually be that difficult. But I think I'd burn through quite a bit quite quickly, to be honest. I think I'd have a good crack at it.
Yeah, I mean, my instinct is always like, well, I give it to all my family members to pay off their mortgages and stuff. And I think, oh, stop being so bloody worthy. You wouldn't. You'd go, you'd get rid of all the rubbish in your wardrobe and get someone else to put some more in there. I'd be tempted to look into buying Derby County, but I don't know what I'd do with the other 183 million, whatever was left over. It's only going to be about fiver, isn't it?
Could I just point out that your question was not what would you do with the 184 million? It was what would the first thing you'd be?
Yeah, sorry, first thing, first be? Thing.
I mean, so you
I'd probably just go and get a beer.
You're not gonna
let's
buy
be realistic.
Derby County straight
away.
Am I looking into it,
Simon? Look, it's, you know, I might, obviously these things take time. There's a fit and proper purposes test that's not going to happen. But no, I'd probably just go and buy a beer and just sit there and just be like, oh my God. I mean, I'd buy the best beer, obviously.
Oh, I'd definitely go for a pint and I'd definitely go out for dinner that night. I think I might phone up Skateboard Ramp Building Company and ask them how much I could overpay them to come and build me a wooden mini ramp half pipe in my garden within the next day. Yeah. That I'd be tempted to do. And I think actually holiday wise, I've realized where I'm going. I think I'm going to go somewhere around the kind of Tahiti kind of area. Nice. With the family, and then come back and think about what to do and how to tackle my sudden wealth syndrome.
Yeah, which is what we're going to talk about now, because actually the couple themselves did, I think they've gone off on a round the world trip with their kids. Very nice thing to do. So sudden wealth syndrome then. I mean, as I said earlier, doesn't sound such a bad syndrome to me, but is it? I mean, we've all read the newspapers, haven't we, of these people that have won the lottery and then years later they're in a bad state.
If you're going to get a syndrome, I think sudden wealth syndrome is quite a good one to get. This is a term coined by psychologist Stephen Goldbart, and it's the collective name given to the psychological issues that are associated with new or sudden wealth. The Money, Meaning and Choices Institute, where Goldbart works, says that those who are suffering from the affliction often experience increased anxiety and insomnia. On top of that, they can have feelings of confusion and guilt about their fortune. It can cause people to make decisions they wouldn't otherwise have made and adopt self-destructive behaviours. Self-destructive behaviours, I think, is the thing to watch out for. You don't want to be Mikey Carroll, the lotto lout, blowing it all on cocaine and banger racing.
I don't think that's what Camelot's advisor would advise you to do.
He may be held up as a cautionary tale rather than a life plan.
Exactly.
Camelot's advisor guides lucky winners through what they can expect in the weeks and months after their windfall. So it works with them to assess what their needs, including, obviously, personal security. So one of the really interesting pieces of advice here is to go public. Now, when these people went public...
Because I just think, oh, my God, everybody would know.
Absolutely, 100%. That is what everybody said. Why would you go public?
Yeah.
You'd never tell people. Why would you do that? Well, Fran, our reporter, spoke to Alex Price, Director of Financial Planning at Charles Stanley, who has served as one of the specialist financial advisors Camelot calls on to support winners. Now, Alex said that you're never going to be able to hide 184 million. You can hide a few million, but that is a life-changing amount of money for you and for everyone you know. So that's the thing, is you could probably, if you won 3 million, maybe keep it under wraps. If you were really careful and quite frugal, people might wonder where that new car had come
inheritance from.
All that kind of, there's a lot of money to inherit and why you're suddenly, but you could probably manage to keep it. If you wanted to live a normal life, you could keep that under wraps. There's always those stories, isn't there, of the person who everybody thought was a totally normal person and they've managed to squirrel away a couple of million. But 184 million, you're not hiding that, are you? I mean, I had, when this was in the news the other day, my wife said to me, you wouldn't move, would you? Well, I mean, I like this house and we've got plans to do an extension and like transform the house. So she said, I'd like to just sort of stay here and go through with the plans. So I was like, yeah, I was kind of thinking of some land. She's like, well, we're lucky, we've got quite a big garden. I said, yeah, kind of thinking of maybe 100 acres, something like that. I'm not necessarily that bothered about that, having a big country pile of a house, although I would quite like one that's quite big. But it's the land that I'd want. And you're not going to be able to hide that, are you, from your friends and family? How come Simon's just moved into a country estate? Well, I don't know, maybe he's doing well at work or something. You're going to have
become
to
become a gardener or something.
Yeah, you're going to have to fess up. And then all of a sudden, you're going to get some problems. You're going to get opportunists knocking on your door. You're going to get the begging letters. You're going to get long lost friends making contact with you. You're going to have robbers. Yeah. You're also going to have to decide who amongst your friends and family you are going to help. And if that is something that you want to do, and what form of help that brings, do you just give them money? Do you make it clear that if they have a business or something else that they want to set up, that you would be willing to set them up? But what if they then just blow the cash because they treat it as easy money? It's very easy to spend other people's money. Do you employ them? You see that a lot, actually, with large family-owned businesses, that you get a lot of sort of family and friends employed with them, and that can lead to all kinds of problems. You could see how people rinse a lot of cash, but I don't think you'd manage to rinse 184 million. But if you did suddenly start giving everybody 5 million, you would dramatically reduce the pot that you've got.
So, I mean, Helen, it's such a big amount of money. What sort of suggestions would a financial advisor, and what a job, make to ensure that that person is financially secure? I mean, I suppose there must be tax issues here, but surely 184, I mean, even the, what's his name again, the Lotto Lout, even with his best efforts, he'd probably pass away before he actually got to spend 184 million.
Mikey Carroll blew 9.7 million.
I mean, that's peanuts in comparison. So, you know, what on earth does a financial advisor actually, what's the advice?
I mean, you've kind of got to invest it because it's so much money, you literally can't put it all in a bank account. So the advisor that Fran spoke to, she said that you can only put about 8 million of it in a bank account at any one time in a sort of standard savings or current account. This couple have got another 176 million that they've got to kind of squirrel away somewhere. And probably quite a good idea is to put some of it into property, put some of it into stocks and shares. You could go around investing in businesses. I mean, the options are absolutely endless. You're right. Would you even put it into a pension? I mean, you've got so much money.
It's to secure your future, isn't it? But I mean, I guess the main issue here would be, Helen, inheritance tax. Sorry, that's awful, because they're a young couple, youngish. That surely must be one of the main concerns, right?
Yeah, because when, you know, whoever you give, even if you give the money away as soon as you can, you know, the people that you give it to, it sort of depends how you do it. But if you're just gifting them sums of money, they're going to have to pay tax on that. So that's something that you have to consider. I mean, one of the things that's mentioned in the article is that you might even end up having to get financial advisors for the people that you're giving the money to. Wow. To help them kind of manage that in the best way. So it's an absolute rabbit hole. I mean, it's obviously a very nice situation to be in, but it does come with a huge host of life admin and problems. And I mean, it would be a full-time job to decide how to handle your huge amounts of money.
I mean, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because as you said, Simon, there are worse syndromes to have. But when you kind of think about all the practicalities of it, you know, every time you go out with your friends, they would then expect you to pay, and you would expect to pay, but it changes the dynamic of the relationships that you have, all these security concerns, because you'd obviously have to have some sort of security detail of some sort. I don't know, but I assume you would. It's a strange one. It's a really strange one.
You're going to end up with staff for a start, in order to just keep tabs on everything, your security, as you said.
Oh, I'd like a chef, actually.
You can have a chef, yeah?
You can have a
rotating cast of chefs, if you like.
Yeah.
You're probably going to end up, as you said, with an entourage following you around everywhere. The sort of the question of what you want to do with the money is really important, I think, be it if you get 184 million or if you're that lucky person who builds a business and sells it for a few million, or is someone who has been lucky enough to work for a business that has given you shares and a stake in the business over the years, and there's been some form of explosive growth story going on, and all of a sudden that business has been sold, or those shares have vested, and you've ended up with a few million. Those are the scenarios that are much more likely to happen to people. Certainly, well, not necessarily at the moment, because those share prices are down quite a lot, but there are not lots of people. But the tech boom has made quite a few people very rich, and also people have managed to build businesses and you know, have a stake in them, or they founded them. And it's then, what do you do with the money? What do you want to do with your life? I mean, one of the most important things that you can do if you end up with that money, with that day that you suddenly end up with that money, is to make sure your will is up to date. That's really important. That's one of the first pieces of advice. And then you also need to think about what you want to do with it. Do you want to set up a business? Do you want to invest it? Do you want to help friends and family? But other considerations are things like philanthropy. Do you want to help out in life? Do you want to support causes that are special to you? Do you want to travel for 6 months of the year? Do you want to make it so that your children don't ever have to work? But do you also want your children to try to understand the value of hard work and not know that they never have to work? Do you want to set up something called a family investment company, which is effectively an investment company where you and members of your family hold shares in it, and you can have one person who might have a control of it, but you all make the decisions, you decide how to invest, and then you all sort of come together to do this. It's effectively a family business where you're investing, and there are some very tax friendly elements of that. I think it's the kind of thing that's not going to be a problem for anybody listening to this podcast, sadly. It's the odds are stacked so badly that it's highly unlikely that any of you are going to win 184 million, but it doesn't stop you dreaming, does it?
No, indeed.
Even after listening to all these problems these poor people are going to face, I'd still take the 184 million.
It's an interesting discussion nonetheless. Just practically though speaking, what literally happens to that money?
Low risk investments. I mean, you can get a certain amount of money into, as Helen said, you get a certain amount of money into an NSNI, which is government backed. You could get a certain amount of money into bank accounts, but you know, at 85, you're going to struggle to get lots of it into bank accounts. At £85,000 a shot on the financial services compensation scheme, you're going to need to open a lot of accounts as well. You will find that there are banks out there who will cater to your needs. And it's highly likely that a lot of your money would go, certainly initially, into high grade government bonds, i.e. US Treasury bills, UK gilts, maybe German bonds. And those are, you're a little bit at the mercy of the markets in terms of the fact that those bond prices can go up or down, but those countries aren't going to default. You're not going to lose your money. And that's the major risk, isn't it? 184 million. Is the sudden loss of money.
Obviously, Helen, probably none of us are ever going to earn or win anything close to this money. Why I do think there's some sort of interesting aspects or themes that have come up in our conversation that relate around money and happiness and how much you need to be happy. And also, there will be situations where someone in a family, for example, perhaps the family don't earn as much, but this person has got a great job and there are expectations whenever they go out to spend money, et cetera, et cetera. I think those are quite interesting themes that actually quite a few of us have to contend with, particularly the how much money do you need to be happy?
It's a really difficult one, isn't it? I spoke to my boyfriend about this when we saw the news about the big Euromillions win, and he said, you know what, he's a bit more of a worthy person than me, we'll say, but he said, you know what, if I won that much money, I'd buy a really nice house, buy a few nice cars, go on a holiday, and then I would honestly give the rest away, because he said he wouldn't want to have to make those kind of decisions of, you know, who in my family do I give money to, how much money do I give them, what if my friends come around asking for loads of money. He was like, I actually just wouldn't want to do it, and I would honestly give most of it away. And I kind of said, oh, you know, you're just saying that, you wouldn't. And he's like, no, honestly, I think it would just make my life so much harder and I wouldn't be bothered with it. You know, it is a problem that I imagine a lot of people have. You know, you get a pay rise. I see it sort of among my friends. Someone's boasting about a new job they've got, and it's like, oh, you buy the round in the pub then. And it kind of happens to all of us, doesn't it, on a smaller scale. I don't know what the answer to it is, really.
I mean, there's a lot of research, isn't there, Simon, that says that actually, I can't even remember what the figures are, but they're not high figures when you talk about money and happiness.
In terms of earnings, the number talked about previously has been around the sort of £45,000 mark. I mean, that will probably need to be £50,000 now because of inflation. But yeah, the numbers aren't that high. And then apparently the happiness level starts to, you can still get happier, but the curve gets less steep. And then you get to a point where you've got enough money and you're really just saving a lot of money, or you're just blowing it on expensive material stuff. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who earn six-figure salaries who manage to spend all the money they get, but they're living reasonably extravagant lifestyles. You don't necessarily need all that stuff to be happy, do you?
No, indeed you don't. Okay, so not exactly as life-altering, as I said, as 184 million, but a £1 million premium bond jackpot is not to be sniffed at. But given the odds of winning it are so low, are the savings products actually worth it? Ennis and I have upped the rate, though, this week. Finally, after four increases to interest rates by the Bank of England over the last 6 months. So do we like the changes, Helen? What have they done?
Yeah, so as I said, this is following on from the four base rate rises in the Bank of England. A lot of banks have been upping their interest rates, and premium bonds don't pay interest, but they do. They give you the chance of winning a prize. So as of June, the odds of each £1 premium bond number winning a prize will go from 34,500 to 1 to 24,500 to 1. So still not huge odds, but they've upped some of the prize amounts as well. So there was two £1 million jackpot winners each month previously. That stayed the same. But the number of £100,000 prizes is going up from 6 to 10, and the number of £50,000 prizes is going up from 11 to 19. So, you know, the odds still aren't great of winning big, but they are slightly better.
Simon, there's been a few disappointments, shall we say, with premium bonds of late. Does this go some way to making people fall back in love with them?
Well, firstly, let me put this in context. Previously, your chances of winning a prize were being one person in Pride Park, Derby County's football ground. Now, your chances of winning a prize...
On a good day or a bad day on a...
Capacity, that's when it's full, nearly full. Now, your chances are one person in Selhurst Park. So there you go, which has a 25,000. It puts it in context, though, doesn't it? The one person in the stadium. I mean, they would have, if to be the one person in Kenilworth Road, Luton Stadium, which has a capacity of just over 10,000, they'd have to dramatically increase the interest rate and amount of prizes. So I think that this is actually quite good, because I think that for many people, it's possible to treat premium bonds as almost like an easy access savings account, right? Because you can get your money out pretty quickly. If you've got an online account, not the easiest thing to set up still, but if you've got an online account, you can get your money out quite fast and with no restrictions. If you do have to remember that you don't get an interest rate return, you get an average amount of luck, you should get the 1.4%. So you might do better than average, you might do worse than average, and so on. But you can go, okay, all right, well, you know what, I'll take around the 1.4% mark that I'm hopefully going to get. And the best instant access savings account at the moment pays 1.31%. And you can't win £1 million with that. I mean, it's highly unlikely you're going to win £1 million with the premium bonds. You would have to be standing in an extremely big stadium to be the one person who did. But I think this is pretty good. It's been a long time coming. Four base.
What took them so long?
They moved slowly.
Okay.
The NS and I has to balance the needs of savers and paying them better rates with the needs of the government in terms of raising funding and its targets for how much money it has to come into the NS&I coffers over the course of the year, and also try not to destabilize the wider savings market. So it tends to move much slower than certainly the challenger banks out there who've been busy raising rates very quickly. And I must say that the premium bonds rate looks an awful lot better than the insult accounts that many of our big banks still have paying people 0.1%.
All right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Ben Laidler of eToro to discuss what's been going on the markets. Ben, how's the week been? What's happened?
Well, I'm pleased to say we've had a much better week. The S&P 500 is on track for over a 5% gain for this week. This will be the first week in eight. I'm almost embarrassed to say that US equities are up. Two drivers of relief there. We've had much better numbers from the US consumer, so we're a little bit less concerned there. And we've had finally some more government spending come out of China, the second biggest economy in the world, so we're a little bit less worried about that. So all this has just helped calm investor nerves more broadly. So that's been one. I think the other one, you know, here in the UK, we've had the government announce $15 billion of help for hard-pressed UK consumers, partly funded by windfall tax on the oil industry. The UK is pretty much the poster child for stagflation. So 10% inflation and flirting with recession in the world right now. So this help is much needed. And it's also a reminder that economies are not stock markets. Despite this sort of stagflationary environment, the UK FTSE 100 continues to be pretty much the best performing of all major equity markets in the world at this point.
So we've had a rare dose of positivity this week. Can we look forward to another one next week? Obviously, in the UK, we've got 2 days off due to the bank holidays.
Which is pretty positive. We get 2 days off. It's a Memorial Day in the US on Monday. So everywhere you look, it's going to be a shortened week. But there's quite a lot going on. I guess the two big things to watch, it's jobs report day in the US on Friday, which is probably going to be pretty strong. And the US Fed is really on autopilot at this point to keep hiking interest rates pretty aggressively. And the next meeting's on June the 15th. So that'll probably continue. We've also got a number of sort of big tech earnings. So this earnings season refuses to go away. We've got Salesforce, Broadcom, Hewlett-Packard, CrowdStrike, all in this environment where investors are pretty nervous. Like last week, we had poor numbers from Snap and the stock price collapsed. So, investors definitely sort of nervous when it comes to earnings. And we have some pretty big ones next week.
Okay, Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Now, buying a property that needs some work is often seen as a great way to secure a bargain. You could do it up yourself, move up the property ladder, or sell it afterwards for a packet, and voila, you are a property magnate. But aspiring renovators may want to hold fire, as new research suggests it will usually end up costing you more in the long run. Helen?
Yes, I think people, especially British people, kind of see this as quite a tantalising prospect, don't they? Buying a bit of a beat up old house and turning it into their dream home. It's something that a lot of people might not do, but a lot of people think they could have a crack at. So this is new research from the estate agent Benjamin Reeves. They've looked at how much it costs to buy a property, a fixer upper, a property that's in need of modernization compared to the rest of the market. So they found that fixer uppers are generally about 4.5% cheaper than sort of comparable modernized homes, they're calling them, so homes that don't need a lot of work in the same area, which is fine, but they find that actually the cost of then doing the work means that it's more expensive overall to buy the fixer-upper. And they're saying that the average modernised home in England, this is kind of looking at larger properties, the data's a bit skewed. So it's those kind of larger properties that people would generally buy to fix up. So in England, the average home costs £374,000. That's the modernised home, whereas an unmodernised home costs £358,000. But the cost of doing it up is just under £57,000. So basically it skews the balance. So generally it's more expensive to buy your fixer upper and do it up than it is to just buy a home that was all right in the first place.
Simon, with all these TV shows though, you'd think it's an easy thing to do. Loads of people do it. Is that the case? Or is it just something we like to, a bit like winning the lottery, like to dream about, but actually not that many people do it?
It's particularly difficult at the moment because building costs have gone up substantially. One of the first things to signal that we were going to have some form of inflation spike that might not be as transitory as central banks thought was the sudden spike in the cost of building materials. And actually, some of that was caused by the sheer difficulty in terms of getting hold of them. But lumber, as the Americans refer to wood, prices went through the roof. You couldn't get hold of some stuff. Some of the sellers to the trade were limiting amounts that they could have. Because of those material costs going up substantially, builders tend to give people fixed price quotes, which includes the cost of materials and the cost of labor. A lot of them got stung on those fixed price quotes if they stood by them and lost margin. They probably still made profit on the jobs, but they lost margin. They're having to pay their staff more money because if you're a brickie or a plumber or a roofer or anything like that, then you can pretty much pick your job at the moment. And if one guy won't pay you X, then you can go to the next guy who might do, or girl. So at the moment, when people are getting quotes, some of them are astronomical. And some of it is good builders effectively quoting themselves out of the job because they've got so much work on, because there has been a property boom, there has been people buying lots of properties, there have been lots of people trying to do extensions, that they don't want the jobs, so they put a silly price on it. And if somebody says, all right, I'll pay that, then they go, right, well, I'll just make it work because I'm not going to turn that down if this mug's mug enough to pay it. Some of it is also them putting slightly higher prices on, or there's an inflation effect going on because they're anticipating higher costs in the future, which is how inflation works. They're anticipating that materials costs will still go up. Actually, materials costs have largely settled at the moment, but because of getting stung on previous jobs, they're putting in an extra buffer to make sure they don't get stung on these ones and also cover the extra cost of employing people. And I was talking to a guy who's been doing a house down the bottom of my road, who's a small scale developer. And he told me you need to budget on a 100 grand job. You need to budget at least 50 grand more than you did. And you can add at least 50% to the labor costs and all these other things. That's how people get caught out with this stuff, because they don't anticipate quite how expensive it can be and also how quickly the prices can move. Mm. But also because, as Helen said, it's a particularly British thing, this desire to buy a slightly rundown house and do it up. There's a whole niche of people out there going, I don't want that fancy house with the just like shiny stuff and everything. I want that one that looks rubbish. I'm in that niche. Okay, I'm always convinced, no, I don't want to pay someone else's profit. I'd rather make the profit myself. It's quite hard.
We've said this on the show, haven't we? Not me. I've never been in this position personally. But we have said, don't buy it the absolutely brand spanking new.
But we are buy something you can add value to, but you need to be able to buy something that you can add value to and make the value. And the problem is because these fixer-uppers are in so much demand and so many people want them, they get priced quite high, and they quite often get quite a few bids on them, which bids the price up. And estate agents in many popular areas will price them for, here's the price of the house, here's the price of what we think the work will cost, which they're probably underestimating because the cost of work has gone up by so much, as I just explained. And so therefore, this is the price of the done house. And then they work backwards from the price of the done house. So they go, if this house was done, it'd be $1 million. And we reckon it costs 200 grand to do the work. So we'll put it on the market for 800, which doesn't leave any profit for the person doing the house, particularly when they discover the building costs have gone up. But because people are so keen on buying them, they tend to overpay for them. Now, what you should be doing is looking at that house and going, okay, well, let's have a look. That house done could be worth $1 million. It's going to cost me 200 grand to do the work. I'm going to budget for at least 300 grand, and I want to make a bit of profit on that. So the most I'd pay is 650. But in many instances, if you walk around going, the most I'd pay is 650, you'll never be able to buy one of those houses. Certainly not at the moment. You'll have to be patient and wait for the market to go down. And I am literally looking at Rightmove as we're talking for an example of this. And I have found a house for sale on a road that needs extending and doing up for £1 million. And the house that it would look like if it was extended and done up, I can see went under offer for £1.3 million. And I reckon that there's definitely at least 300 grand's worth of work in order to get house A to house B. So if you bought house A and turned it into house B, you would have done all that work, taken on all that risk, and you would have made zero profit. So maybe you might.
That's if you want to sell it immediately. If you'd held on to it, you know, in the future.
Well, but then the same is true of house B that's already done. This is like we talk about behavioral traps, right? Behavioral finance stuff, behavioral traps in investing all the time, don't we? We're always talking about that. It's one of Tanya's favorite things to talk about as well. But we definitely do this when we buy property in this country. We fall into all kinds of behavioral traps that are very similar to the investing ones. And the first one is, well, the last house I bought went up in value by loads, so I must be really good at buying houses. So I'll buy this house and I'll make money. Yeah, that guy might not do it because I don't know if they've made money, but I made money in the past, so I'll make money in the future. That's not how stuff works.
I'll be honest with you. I couldn't be arsed with the hassle of doing that. If I want a home, I want it done. I don't want to have to imagine. My imagination's not good enough. Helen, is it worth the hassle? Well, for most people, they should probably just get something they actually want to live in. I mean, it depends if you want to live in it or you're thinking about investment, but there are other ways to invest in property.
That's the thing. I mean, it really depends on where you're at in your life, what you want out of your house. You know, for some people, if they're buying their, as people love to call it, their forever home, you know, they're going to be here for years and years and years. They want the house to be exactly as they want it. You know, maybe they don't actually mind about necessarily making it a great great profit when they come to sell on, because it really depends what you do to the house, right? So the things the buyers want, you know, they want a bigger house with a bigger footprint, or they might want some of the agents in the piece that we wrote were talking about doing sort of energy efficiency improvements, so buyers in the future would be able to see that they might have lower bills. They're the kind of things that could make you a good profit, but they might not necessarily be the things that you actually want to do to your house. You know, you might want to do something really obscure. You might want to build a bungalow in your garden, or like for your mum to live in. Like there's a million and one things you do to your house to make it a house that you want to live in, and they're not necessarily things that future buyers are going to want to pay for. So you have to really think about what is going to make that a house that you want to live in, and what your priorities are. You know, if some people do buy a house and, you know, with the full knowledge that they're going to try and sell it in 5 years' time and make a decent profit, and that's fine. But, you know, you've got to think about your priorities, what you want out of it, and also what you're prepared to do, right? You know, if you're a handy person, you can do a lot of the little jobs yourself, that's going to make the process a lot easier than if you're someone who really doesn't have the ability to do any of that yourself, and the costs are going to add up with that. And if you don't enjoy that kind of thing, you're going to find the whole experience a real kind of hassle. So just think about whether it's actually for you would probably be my advice.
The other thing is watch the size of the house. So you can add value to properties that are tatty just by tarting them up. That is literally the easiest way to do it. The way that you end up costing yourself lots of money is by doing a load of building work. So watch the size of the house. If the house is quite small and therefore you would need to do quite a lot of building work, then that's where you're potentially going to end up costing yourself a small fortune. If, though, you could do something that's relatively cost efficient, for example, it's got a nice big high roof on it and you could very easily do a loft conversion or something like that, or maybe you just need to do a small single story ground extension, or it's got a rubbish single story, it's got a rubbish extension that you can actually improve in some way, then that's where you can definitely quickly add some value.
All right, then, another area that maybe something of a bit of a money pit, as houses have been called, this summer, particularly if you're heading abroad, car rental. If you're wanting to rent a car abroad, watch out, because this is money you've found is a little bit more dearer than you might be expecting. Helen, what's been uncovered?
Yeah, so people planning their first or big holiday after COVID are going to perhaps be in for a bit of a shock when they come to rent a car. So this is some research that this money has got from icarhireinsurance.com. So they're saying that to hire a medium-sized hatchback in popular European holiday destinations for 1 week at the end of July, that's going to cost an average of £675. So that's double the price that it was for the same car hire in 2019. That was £339. So that's adding a really decent chunk to the cost of your holiday.
Wow, what's the reason?
Shortage of cars. Same reason the car hire prices were have been going through the roof for the past couple of years. But this year, the shortage of cars has met an extremely unfortunate vehicle traveling in the other direction, a large number of holiday makers. We thought it was bad last year. It's much worse this year, because last year there weren't that many people going on holiday. Now everybody's trying to go on holiday, not just from the UK, but all over Europe. The staycation, people have said, well, you know, that was nice, but I'm going to go on holiday to another country this year because I haven't been for a couple of years. And they're trying to hire cars. And there is a shortage of cars because car makers can't make enough cars because they have a shortage of computer chips. The semiconductor shortage is still affecting the car manufacturing industry, and many of them cannot make cars quickly enough. The hire car companies work on the basis that they turn over their cars maybe once a year, usually. And in the sort of original lockdown, what was it, 2020, when everybody was locked down everywhere, a lot of car hire companies thought they were going to go bust and sold off their stock to try to get money in the belief that they would then be able to buy cars back when they needed them. What they didn't anticipate was the throttling of the ability to make cars by the car making industry and then sell them those cars. And also the fact that the car making industry has decided that it's much keener on selling to consumers than it is in selling en masse to fleet buyers such as car hire companies. So it's pretty tough, actually. And I must admit, I discovered this last summer when our car hire cost us double what it did for pretty much the same week. The year earlier, we did actually manage, we were one of those people who managed to escape the country for a week or so in 2020. And I discovered it in February time. I thought it would have gone away or would have at least eased when I ended up with a car hire. And this is all comparing prices from Zurich for a weekend snowboarding that was 150% more expensive than I'd paid pre-pandemic, but then amazingly lucked out because I quickly checked up on prices randomly about 3 weeks before I went and discovered that I could get the same car for £175 less. So I cancelled my existing booking and took the new one and saved myself £175. But I was looking at car hire for holiday this summer as well. I managed to find some reasonable flights for the family. I was like, okay, £600 for all four of us. That could be all right for 2 weeks. And then I looked at the cost of car hire, £850 for something that you would normally previously have paid £300 to £400 max for. So I think the next step is what do people do about this? I think some people are going to make decisions not to go to places on holiday, places that they would need a car, or they're going to make decisions to go on holidays where they're not going to need a car. Maybe to places where they can walk around. Maybe it's going to see an uplift in package holiday sales, for example. Or maybe you can think outside the box and can you get somewhere where you can get a train from the airport to where you're going to stay, or maybe a coach, and then can you do your holiday without a car? And I would say that there'll be some people listening to this going, of course you can holiday without a car. Why would you need a car on holiday? Mm. Many people do go on holiday without a car. It's much easier if you don't have kids. And mm-hmm. you're not staying in a you know, a rental property or something, and you need to do that whole drive to the supermarket thing or something. So yeah.
If you do need a car though, and the most sensible suggestion for you is to take your own car, and you obviously going to somewhere where you can take your car, what do you need to consider? Because we've had all sorts of things like Brexit go on since then.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to need a sticker that says UK, not GB. GB yeah. stickers don't work anymore. You have right. to have one that says UK. You obviously will need to check your insurance. You will need to take your paperwork with you. Mm. But other than that, you're totally fine to go drive in Europe.
Okay, good to know. All right, well, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. Is it even iTunes anymore? Is it called that?
Apple Podcasts, Spotify.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.